like you to take your message notes and turn in your Bibles. And we read Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 20, as we talk about overcoming inertia. Last week it was overcoming accusations. Next week, Pastor Steve Pulis will be preaching. I am on a ministry trip next weekend, and he'll be talking about overcoming discouragement, which will come in chapter 4. Nehemiah's story, as he rebuilds the walls of Jerusalem and as he restores the gates, which would bring together back security and functionality to the city of Jerusalem, in much the same way the Lord wants to in all of our lives. The storyline is just him overcoming one obstacle after another. And today, it's overcoming inertia. So be forewarned, there's going to be a physics lesson this morning. Verse 20 of Nehemiah chapter 2 is where we left off last week. Nehemiah to his critics, "The God of heaven will give us success. So we, his servants, will start rebuilding." And if you are, if you have your notes out and a pen, you can just circle that word "start." That's the problem word today. What does it take to start? Sometimes finishing well is harder than starting well, but starting well is plenty tough in itself. And I've come with just a sense in my heart this morning, there's numbers of you, there's some really important things you need to get accomplished in your life. There's some relationships that need rebuilding. Some of you need to accept that promotion you've been offered at work. Maybe not, but some of you need to. Some of you, God's been speaking to you for a long time about writing something, about maybe going back to school. I mean, you've got to start somewhere. There's something of a rebuilding character, a next step character in your life. But the thing that works against us is that wonderful physical property called inertia. So I have here a can of Diet Coke, caffeine-free at that. There was a physicist 350 years ago who came up with what we call Newton's three laws of motion. Isaac Newton was one of the most brilliant physicists in history. And his third law was that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. So that's why rockets work, right? Exhaust comes out the bottom, and the reaction is that there's lift to the rocket. His second law was where we get weight from. And it says that force, I mean, I don't know how he discovered this, but he said force is really the mass of an object times its acceleration. And there's the accelerating force of gravity operating on this can of Coke. So its weight is its mass times its acceleration. The gravitational acceleration at sea level is 32 feet per second squared. So from that you find weight. He said, force. There's forces everywhere in life. Force is something's mass times its acceleration. But his first law is the law of inertia. And it says, if an object is sitting there stationary, it will stay stationary forever unless a force, an unbalanced force, operates on it. So I could add a force and I could move it. The other part of the law of inertia, so we would say that can of Coke has inertia. It stopped, and it would take effort to get it moving, right? The first law of motion is that it can't move if it's already stopped without effort being applied to it. But that first law of inertia also says that if it is moving, unless some other force acts on it, it will keep moving at that same speed and in that same direction forever. Now, if I had a very long table here, this would not roll forever because there are some frictional forces between the can and the table. There's a little bit of air resistance operating on it, so slowly it would slow down. But it would slow down because of those forces acting on it. If there's no forces, if this was frictionless and there was no air resistance, that can would just keep going and going and going. And it would not only go at the same speed, but it would go in the same direction. It would take a force to change its direction. That's the law of inertia. Then momentum momentum is what we would call the quantity of motion, or some people just say mass in motion. So let's say that can's just standing there. It has no inertia and it has no momentum. Momentum would be its mass times its speed, its velocity. So it has no momentum. However, if it's rolling slowly, it would have some momentum. And for you geeks out there, you know that the force that would take to stop that momentum would be the change in momentum divided by a unit of time. And so momentum, we use that word a lot, even the word inertia, you know? We would say, that car has a lot of inertia because it would take a lot to stop it. It means it has momentum. Sometimes our favorite sports teams have momentum. Sometimes we say, I'm on a roll, right? Every organization functions better when it has momentum. I mean, momentum just makes your life functions better when, you know, the wind's in your back and you got momentum. Because Newton's law says it would actually take a force to stop momentum, but it doesn't take any effort to keep going. That's where you want to get in your life, right? You want to get on a roll. You want to get momentum working for you and not against you. Inertia is a resistance to change in motion or direction. And so you're always working against inertia, but if you have momentum, inertia is working for you. If you're stopped, inertia is working against you, and you have no momentum. Now, this was Nehemiah's problem. That's a little physics, and that is a lot of life. And this was Nehemiah's problem. He said, we as servants will, what? Start. Say that word with me. Start rebuilding. And there lies the challenge. Because Jerusalem and its walls had been destroyed 100 years earlier. For an entire century, that was the momentum they had behind rebuilding. Nothing. There's no momentum. And the inertia was working against them. It would take, right, a force applied to get the project going. And when it comes to accomplishing things in life, we all know that starting can take a lot of energy. But I'm amazed at what Nehemiah did in order to start. First of all, he broke the project into pieces. He broke it into pieces. This is chapter 3 of Nehemiah. Whole walls can't be built at once. You can't take an 8-ounce steak and swallow it all at once. You've got to break it up into chewable pieces. Every project, every major task, you're likely going to have to do what Nehemiah did. He broke the project into pieces. Let's get a feel for that in verse 1 of chapter 3 of Nehemiah. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests, they went to work. So this is the first moment that work starts on the wall. They went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. And they dedicated it and set its doors in place. For every little piece of accomplishment, it's good to throw a party to celebrate your win. So don't wait till it's all done to celebrate it. They just took the first piece, they got it done, and they dedicated it, and they celebrated it. And then they dedicated it and set its doors in place. And then building as far as the Tower of the Hundred, which was the name of some of the towers around the walls, and they dedicated it, and they went as far as the Tower of Hananel. Verse 2, then the men of Jericho built the adjoining section, the next section, and Zachar, son of Imri, built next to them. And the fish gate was rebuilt by the sons of Hassanah. And they laid its beams and put in its doors and bolts and bars in place. Verse 4. And by the way, it's a long chapter, and this is all it is. A lot of unpronounceable names and towers and gates, right? Like verse 4. Meremoth, and I'll spare you all the names. He repaired the next section. Next to him, Meshullam made repairs, and next to him, Zadok also made repairs. When we add all of this together and get through the entire chapter, that when you get to it in your daily Bible reading, you go, oh no, Nehemiah 3, oh Jesus, this is going to be like really tough. I mean, that's all it is, but there's something brilliant happening here. Nehemiah is describing how Nehemiah broke the project into pieces. In fact, when you read all the way through chapter 3, you realize there were 42 wall sections. He broke the walls down around Jerusalem into 42 sections, and they're all named in a counterclockwise direction as you read through chapter 3. On top of that, there are 10 gates to the city that are used as reference points. It's like they rebuilt this section of the wall from this gate to this gate, or at least, and there are towers between the gates, so from this tower, and then that tower to that, and then that tower to that gate. It was broke. These 42 sections have as reference points 10 gates. There was the sheep gate, the fish gate, the old gate, the valley gate, the dung gate, the fountain gate, the water gate. Oh, man. Are you talking about President Nixon or Nehemiah here? There was even Watergate. And the horse gate, and the east gate, and the inspection gate. Some of these were commerce gates, some of these were service gates, and some of these were locational gates, like the east gate and the valley gate. So 42 wall sections in a counterclockwise direction, 10 gates as reference points, and 41 parties of people working. You'll find 41 subgroups, 41 teams of people working. So he not only broke the project into his pieces, but he broke his volunteer labor force into small sections as well and distributed them out. Here's a picture of a diagram of the walls. And here's the sheep gate. Here's the temple right here. So the temple's here. Back in that time, you came down the hill of David and the old city of David. Some people think that Nehemiah may have actually built out here around some of Hezekiah's destroyed walls, but many scholars believe he at least did this much with his limited resources. And he started up here at the sheep gate. And so if you follow chapter 3, it goes counterclockwise this way as they built piece by piece. So there's the fish gate, the old gate, the valley gate, the dung gate, the fountain gate, and all these gates. In between were towers that are named there. If you were to kind of put this to an artist's schematic, it would look like this. Next picture, where here's the temple. Okay, so this is the Temple Mount up here, and the temple had been rebuilt. It had also been destroyed by the Babylonians. It was rebuilt, but Nehemiah's task is to rebuild this whole broken wall, and then the gates. The 10 gates are where commerce and city politics took place, governance. And so the gates would keep the enemy from, the walls would keep the enemy from intruding and provide security for the city. And the gates would restore functionality to the city. And economic and political activities could be carried on. So that's what Nehemiah was facing. You got a group of volunteers. You don't have a lot of time, and you've got, they built this in 52 days, which was an engineering and a leadership miracle. But part of it was, where do you start? He just, he broke it into pieces. And then Nehemiah started somewhere. Let's leave that up. Could you just go back one more time? He started somewhere. And verse 1 tells us they started at the sheep gate. And that's right up here. Now, why the sheep gate? Why didn't you start at the dung gate and get that dirty work done first? Well, I don't know. I mean, sometimes there's no telling. You just start somewhere, because the hardest part of the job is getting from stuck to moving. And it takes force. It takes energy invested to go from doing nothing to doing something. So first of all, you want to break it into doable pieces so that the whole project isn't overwhelming. And then you want to get started somewhere. Verse 1 again. Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gate. No explanation, but you got to start somewhere. Don't overthink this. You know, some of us are afflicted with the paralysis of analysis, right? I mean, you overthink it. I mean, you'll never be ready completely to start somewhere. You'll never be ready for this. You always start before you're completely ready, because the hardest part is starting. And so you do something. Mark Batterson, in his book, Wild Goose Chase, writes, "In my experience, signs follow decisions. The way you overcome spiritual inertia and produce spiritual momentum is by making tough decisions. And the tougher the decision, the more potential momentum it will produce. The primary reason most of us don't see God moving is simply because we aren't moving. And if you want to see God move, you usually always need to make a move." I brought a book up here, not because I wrote it, but I have to tell you a story about this. It's Lead So Others Can Follow. I wrote this book about 4 or 5 years ago for paid and volunteer leaders in a local church. It's not that long a book. It's about 135 pages. I think there's roughly 4,000 sentences in this book. But you know, when I wrote this book, and I didn't use a ghostwriter, I just wrote it myself, I didn't know if it was going to get published, first of all. But I just felt I was spending part of a day with the Lord. I kind of all of a sudden saw this outline. So I'd broken it into pieces. I mean, the Lord helped me with that. I just saw this outline. And so I knew how the pieces would fit together. And I felt like I was supposed to write this. But I didn't know anybody would publish it. I just knew, even if it was just a Word document on my hard drive, I need to write it. So I had my outline, I had everything lined up, I kind of knew the various topics I'm going to talk about. But of the 4,000 sentences in this book, I want you to guess what the hardest sentence to write was. Yes, you're right. You're way ahead of me. It was the first sentence. I could, to this day, 5 years later, tell you where I was sitting in Terminal D of Dallas-Fort Worth Airport waiting for an airplane. I could tell you the precise chair I was sitting in when, in front of my laptop, I finally took a deep breath and dared to write the first sentence. It was the hardest sentence I wrote. I re-edited it at least 15 times. But just starting, I mean, that's the big challenge, right? So I want to encourage you, you know, did I feel like I had everything like lined out about what the next 4,000 sentences would be? No, you can't do that. You'll never get around to starting anything. But you start somewhere. Nehemiah started with the sheep gate. And then I learned as I watched Nehemiah walking through chapter 3 that if you're going to start, you have to at some point always question your excuses for not starting. You got to question those excuses. Look what it says in verse 5. Of Nehemiah 3. The next section was repaired by the men of Tekoa. But their neighbors, their nobles, the men of Tekoa, their nobles would not put their shoulders to the work under the supervisor. You got 40 other work teams plus this one, and everybody's working. I mean, everybody's just beginning to get at it. Momentum. I mean, things are now on a roll. Momentum's being built. And you have this one group of city officials from Tekoa. Tekoa was the hometown of the famous Old Testament prophet Amos. It's about 5 miles directly south of Bethlehem, which would have put it not that far from Jerusalem. And there is no explanation given, but there's always somebody in the crowd, whether it's stubbornness or rebellion or just all the excuses we come up with. Everybody is working, and they're not. They refuse, it says, to put their shoulders to the work. In the Hebrew word for shoulders there means really the back part of the neck. It was an intentional analogy to an oxen that refused to take on the yoke. In other words, they just refused to work. They wouldn't come under the labor of it. They wouldn't come under the hard work of it. They just were sitting around while even other people in their town were doing the work for them. And we don't know why, but this can happen to us. And although we're not told what their excuses were, you know, we know what a lot of our excuses are. And the modern word we have for this is procrastination. You know, I read a study recently that's about 20% of the American population are chronic procrastinators. And if you're a student, that goes up to 80%. I'm sorry. I'm just the messenger. But I get that. I went to grade school and university for 21 years straight. And I understand the power of procrastination. The power of procrastination. Someone says procrastination is the art of keeping up with yesterday. And procrastinators have reasons for why I'm not going to start, at least today. Proverbs 22, verse 13, I put this in your notes. The sluggard says, he's the consummate procrastinator, the guy who just sleeps all day, never gets around to starting anything. The sluggard says, there's a lion outside, I'll be killed in the public square. Can you imagine that? He's just sitting in his flat in town and lying in his bed and said, well, I can't go to work today because there might be a lion out there and he's going to eat me alive. You know, and then he believes it. Or he lets it talk him into doing nothing. You know, you break it into pieces and you start somewhere, but it's somewhere in that process you're going to have to confront, you're going to have to question the excuses to not start. And here's our reality check from Henry Ford. You can't build a reputation on what you're going to do. Be very careful when you're spending most of your time planning what you're going to do rather than just, as we just said, starting somewhere, even when your plans aren't fully developed. And then if you have become that kind of person, you're full of good intentions, you just always plan, yeah, I'm going to have that conversation with that person. Yeah, well, I'm going to look for that new job at some point. Yeah, well, I'm going to go get a doctor's appointment. I've been putting it off for 3 years. You know, I mean, there's usually things you tell yourself that you need to question behind your procrastination. I wrote a few down. Like, I might fail. I know people have had such a strong fear of failure that they won't even start for fear they'll fail. I had a student friend who wouldn't even go to class because he so feared failing in that class that he couldn't even bring himself to start. Or if you're a perfectionist, you may have procrastinator tendencies yourself. I mean, it's like, okay, if I do it, I'm not worried about failing, but I may not do it perfectly. And that would be just unthinkable to me. And so sometimes we say, well, I can't do it perfectly, so I'm not. It just keeps us from even starting. You know, I believe in excellence, but I don't believe in perfection when it comes to our performance. Or here's the big one. There are people going to hell because of this lie. I have plenty of time. I've had people tell me, well, I'm just going to enjoy the world for a while. I have plenty of time to come to Jesus someday. And they're in hell today. Because you don't necessarily, I've been at, 3 funerals this week. You never know when your moment's coming. And, you know, it's a lie to think you have plenty of time. And when I put off a project, I did it recently this week because I planned out my time. There was something I decided to do right away, but I was saying to myself, you know, I don't have to do it right away because I got plenty of time. You know what? And I was so glad I did it right away because that turned out to be a lie that I had plenty of time. That just did not work. I had too many things intruded on my schedule. Or the opposite one, I won't have enough time. Sometimes procrastinators wait to the last minute and then they don't have time. And then they go, I mean, these are just excuses that we come in. Or sometimes it's, you know what, it's no use. It's no use. It's no use. Why should I even start? I mean, nothing I do amounts to anything. It's just no use. Sometimes I go to the gym and I go, well, I'm not sure this is any use. Then I have to say to myself, you know, I'm not doing this for me. I'm doing this for a church that needs a pastor. And I'm doing this for a wife that needs a husband. I'm doing this for 2 daughters that need a father. You know, if you can't do it for yourself, at least do it for the people you love. But you got to confront the excuses at some point. Or the ultimate excuse, I just don't feel like it. But you realize if values in our world were determined by what we feel, what a chaotic place we'd have. You know what? There are some things worth doing whether you feel like it or not. And those we call our values. Those we call our convictions. Some things just mean, you know I don't feel like this. Did I feel like writing that first sentence? Mm-mm. But I knew I had an assignment from the Lord, and I knew maybe I could help pastoral teams and volunteer teams in churches around the country if I if I would get this done. And eventually your values have to outweigh your feelings. And this is all a part of breaking it into its pieces, starting somewhere, and then learning to question the excuses for not building up more and more momentum. And then the last thing Nehemiah does is he never underestimated teamwork. He never underestimated teamwork. Verse 7, just pressing on a little farther. In chapter 3, next to them, repairs were made by men from Gibeon and Mizpah. Melatiah of Gibeon and Jadon of Meronoth, places under the authority of the governor of Trans-Euphrates. Now, Trans-Euphrates today is like way north Syria, like the Aleppo region, and then into present-day Iraq. He said it was under the governance of people a long way away, and they weren't even in the city of Jerusalem. They were in communities in the area of the tribe of Benjamin and nearby. But they came. I mean, this was an amazing team that Nehemiah began to assemble. People who weren't even locals. But they started to come. And then verse 8 says, Uzziel, son of Hariah, one of the, who? The goldsmiths, repaired the next section. If that isn't bad enough, how would you like a perfume maker to be your carpenter? And he made repairs next to that. And also listed are business people and priests. I mean, you certainly don't want a preacher being your carpenter. And a perfume maker and a goldsmith. And a business guy who's never picked up a hammer in years. But all these guys become a part of this team. It's the most amazing team. It's eclectic. It's varied. It's everybody throwing their effort in. And then my favorite one is verse 12. As the father of two daughters. Shallum, ruler of the half district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. I love that. I can just hear mom, where you been today, girls? Oh, we've been helping dad. We've been helping dad. I mean, the guy just even recruited his daughters because there's a section of that wall that needs to get rebuilt. And so these amazing teams come together. I want to tell you, if you're stuck, break it into pieces. Start somewhere. At least get over the inertia of doing nothing. Add the force to at least get started somewhere. And make sure you question all your excuses along the way for not doing it. And then bring people around you. This may not be appropriate for every task you have in your life. But this is what accountability is in the community of Christ. It's bringing people around me. I've met with guys, you know, for years, different guys that invest in my life. I try to invest in theirs. And I remember having a conversation one day. The guy had been putting off his annual physical, just procrastinating. And he said, okay. And I just told him, well, I'm going to have mine next week. He said, okay, that encourages me. He said, will you promise me that when we have breakfast in 3 weeks, you will ask me if I scheduled my physical or not. You know what? And that's just a little force to get you off stuck, right? That's just a little force to get you going. I mean, we need this. If you got a terrible job, you got to do some kind of like unpack, like or clean closets or do something. Why don't you ask a few people to help you and feed them and make it a party and do it with people. I mean, teamwork. I mean, the longer I live, the less I ever want to do things when I'm not in a team. I mean, we're more creative. We're more motivated. It's just powerful. I mean, if you've got to grab your own kids, do it. I love some of our greeters here. I mean, they grab their own children to be greeters. You know, it's like the two daughters helping their dad. I mean, I love this. This is what we do. Most of what we do in Christian community is what we do in teams. We do it together. We do it encouraging one another. We're living in accountability with others, which is giving people permission to walk spiritual growth with us and speak us into our lives and nicely slap us upside the head if we need it, because we can't do this alone. No human being can reach their potential alone. We need accountability partners. We need cheerleaders. We need partners who roll up their sleeves and do the work with us. It just makes a total difference when you start engaging the tough things in your life, even a prayer partnership. I mean, you got a big problem in your family. You got to have a difficult conversation with somebody. You've been putting it off for a year. You know, and somebody else probably can't be there with you, but they'll at least become your prayer partner. And somebody knows you're going to have that. And you know they're going to be calling you later saying, how did it go? I mean, these are the things that keep us going. And you know what? We're just so blessed in the family of God with all our gifted people. I mean, this place is full of gifted people, like beyond what we can imagine. And I always have felt, pastoring Central, that my biggest challenge is just tapping the unmet potential in this congregation. I mean, amazing, amazing potential. Victoria was leading us in the last worship song right from here and playing the guitar. I went to my schedule doesn't allow this for everybody, but I did go to her senior recital at Evangel University last night. And she, for a bachelor's degree, did a master's level recital in quality and extent. I mean, I couldn't believe what came out of her. I mean, the incredible gifting. And then a little ensemble, and Pastor Tom, what a choir director he is. I mean, he led a little ensemble in it. It had Ben who was standing down there at the end on this, and amazing voices, and instrumentalists, and like Natalie Slater, just unbelievable on the violin, I mean, who worships and attends here. And yeah, it's just amazing talent we have. That's just music. I mean, we have incredible resources. I want to tell you, there's people who might be worth having a cup of coffee with when you're facing having to start something new. And just pick their brain and just learn. Don't think you've got all the ideas. Don't think you've got all the creativity. I mean, years ago, I learned to become nervous when I didn't have people better than me around me. You know, because I'm such a lid. I mean, if all I've got is me, I mean, poor project. But it's amazing. You're surrounded with gifted people. Let's be the body of Christ. Let's start. You know, break it into its pieces, yes. Just get going somewhere so at least you're getting a little momentum working for you. Question your excuses, but then bring people in and see what can be accomplished. I mean, 41 teams of people Nehemiah had to do this, even with dads pulling their daughters into the work. It was awesome. This is what he did. I'm amazed at our gifted people. And you know who your greatest senior partner, often tell Christian business owners, you know, your senior partner is Jesus. I think of some of your lives, you've been going this direction for a long time. And you know, the word repent means to not just stop, not just to feel guilty, but it means to turn around. Newton's first law says that if you are in one constant direction, you'll never change that direction without an outside force. Some of us think, oh, I can fix up my life all by myself. You can't. But this is the most gifted person that's ever walked the face of the earth, Jesus Christ. He created the heavens and the earth. Look what it says about him in Matthew 20:28. The Son of Man, Jesus, did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. He got the ball rolling for you and me. That tombstone rolled away. And he said, my resurrection power can give all the force that's needed for you to turn around and start going the other direction. Newton's first law says that, especially when there's a lot of momentum, it takes a lot of force to turn that around. And we underestimate how much it takes to redirect our lives. But if your life is going in the wrong direction, there's a Jesus who came to serve you, to give you everything you need to turn around the inertia of the direction and the speed with which you've been heading that direction in your life, to turn it around and to get you going. I don't think I'll ever open this can because there's another physics law. It's called the physics of fizz. You don't want to be around me when I open that can.